of information theory, and the idea for my talk was to provide some kind of just a gentle introduction, particularly because this meeting has quite a mix of people. And there are, of course, some usual suspects, and, you know, I know you and you know me, and, there's a random matrix mafia in quantum information theory, but there are also some courageous souls attending this meeting who haven't, I don't think, in the past been exposed to quantum information. And the original idea for this introductory talk was to give some kind of whirlwind tour of all the different ways in which random matrices pop up in quantum information. But then I realized that this three-day meeting is already going to be a whirlwind tour of all the different ways that random matrices pop up in quantum information. And so compressing a three-day whirlwind into a one-hour whirlwind was not necessarily going to be particularly helpful. And so instead, I'm just going to take probably one of the most well-known, canonical, famous examples of a random construction in computer science information theory and show you how when you translate that problem into quantum information theory, and we have to figure out what that means, you immediately get out a random matrix problem. And that's kind of emblematic of what happens all over quantum information, that there are random matrix problems lurking behind every corner if you just know how to look. And so for the quantum information people, this is going to be review. And since you haven't had your coffee, you may very well actually fall off to sleep. But I hope that for a few of the people in the audience who haven't been exposed before, this will be a little bit of a warm-up, kind of set the stage. And then from here on in, the whirlwind tour will continue. I guess a very famous random construction. So I guess I'm using the blackboard, trying to be informal. That means you should feel free to interrupt me at any point. So if there's anything that is a little bit unclear, like just put up your hands and ask, and I'm very happy to stop and explain. Now, so the very famous random construction that I'm going to talk about is just error correcting codes. I mean, if this is a conference on information theory, then error correcting codes are a natural thing to talk about. And let's just think about what's called the binary symmetric channel. So this is a model of noise that might affect your bit, and we can just represent it as a little matrix. So your input bit can go to 0, or it can go to 1. If it starts off as 0, and if it's a 1, it can also go to 0 or to 1. And we say that the bit remains the same. That is, it's uncorrupted with probability 1 minus p, and the bit is flipped with probability p. And so this is just an example of a stochastic map. And in general, in information theory, noisy channels, right, so ways that your data might be corrupted, are represented by stochastic maps in this way. Now, suppose that you want to use this thing to actually communicate. So you have, you have some medium through which you can send bits, and those bits are corrupted according to the binary symmetric channel. Now, you're not going to get very far if you're only allowed one use of this thing. So let's imagine that we can use it many times, and those uses are independent. So we have many uses. So we have some Pn of a bit string y1 through yn, given an input bit string x1 through xn, is just given by the product of these conditional probabilities. And I may use the notation that I'll use y superscript n to denote the bit string, with the subscripts representing the individual bits, and likewise for xn. So we have access to this thing, and we'd actually like to use it to communicate. So what can we do? We can think of our communication system. We'll have some box where we have this stochastic map. That's our medium. And into that box, we're going to send some stuff. And out of that box, we're going to get some stuff. And ultimately, back here, we have some message that we'd like to send. So we have maybe some Z, which is an M-bit message. So member of 0, 1 Cartesian product M times. So the most general thing we could do here is just plug that message that we have into some stochastic map, right? So it goes into the stochastic map. The output of our encoding function or our encoding map goes into the noisy channel, and then of course we have to decode it in some way, so we get some output, and out of that maybe we'll get something I'll call z hat. And ideally, what we'd like is that the probability that z is not equal to z hat should go to zero as n goes to infinity, right? And I'll be a little bit fuzzy about whether that should mean it should go to zero for all z's, or go to, if we impose maybe the uniform distribution over z's, it should go to zero for most z's, or that kind of thing. So here's a communication system. And the big question, so this is the problem that, of course, one of the problems that Shannon looked at in 1948, most of you are probably familiar with it. And when you're faced with this sort of general problem trying to figure out, you know, how do you actually find an appropriate F and G, right? So how to find, let's say, near optimal F, right? And what does near optimal mean? Well, it actually means that if we look at the ratio of the number of bits that we actually get to transmit with low probability of error to the total number of bits that were physically transmitted through that, or rather the number of uses of the channel, so that ratio is the rate, that this should actually go to 1 minus 20 h of p. So h of p is known as the entropy, binary entropy. So minus p log p log space 2 . So it's not too hard to prove that you can never do better than this. And so if you can actually find codes that achieve this rate, then you're saying, okay, I'm basically, I'm effectively optimal. All right, so what observations can we make? So now I ask, you know, audience participation time. I said that F, in principle, it could just be itself be some stochastic map. But is there any advantage to making F stochastic?
In this particular set? The answer is actually no.
So, so F might as well be a function. So all F really is an assignment of the input bit strings to, or let's say an assignment of messages to input bit strings for the channel, right? That just, so you just have to choose. Effectively, you're choosing some subset of the bit strings at the input of the channel, and that's your F. Okay, well, beyond that, so we've identified something about the structure of F. You know, we don't have to really worry about it being a stochastic map; it can just be a deterministic function. What else might we do? You know, how do we proceed from here? I mean, actually, people have thought about this for 60 years, and so we actually know some very explicit things that can be done, you know, in the absence of knowing, actually, some people in this room probably do know the explicit things that can be done. But what's a natural thing to try? How might we construct an F that might stand some chance of working here? Yeah, exactly, right? And of course, I think everyone in the audience knew that was going to be the answer. That in the absence of really knowing how to construct an F with good properties, the thing that works, you know, miraculously more often than one could reasonably hope is just to choose an F at random. And so in this particular case, what we could do is we could just say, so choose F of Z uniformly at random from the bit strings of length n, right? And do it independently for each of the different z's. Right, so this is an encoding that has basically no structure. Right, we've really just chosen random bit strings to generate our function. We haven't even worried about collisions or anything else. Right, and it turns out that this actually works. Right, that if you choose your f this way, then you are going to achieve these rates, and the proof is not particularly difficult. You just average. So we can average the probability that z is not equal to z hat, let's say, assuming that we had the uniform distribution on z, over choices of f. And what you find is as long as you make this m slightly less than n times 1 minus h of p, then this probability is actually going to go to 0 in exactly the way that you want it to. And it's actually an easy calculation. It's really just sort of a question of sort of packing and looking at some law of large numbers. Now, of course, in this game, one thing that's interesting is that the hard work was really, at least it is in the existence proof, or rather, I should say that if we average over choices of f, and we find that this error probability is small, then that means, in particular, that there's some particular choice of f, right? And that this is just the nature, you know, this is the standard probabilistic method. It doesn't tell us anything about the structure of f. And ultimately, if you're an information theorist or you're interested in the engineering questions, this is just the first step in some long process where you're going to try to make f more and more explicit. And there are going to be some talks, about in some sense, making some of these our random matrix problems or techniques more explicit. But one of the interesting properties of the way that this is set up also is that I've really only talked about f here, not very much about g, right? And it's one of the, it doesn't take too much thought to realize that, of course, if you choose a good f, then g is more or less determined for you, right? That a particular input, or given a part, if you've chosen a good encoding function, then when you look at a particular output of the channel, there's usually only one reasonable choice to guess for the input. That's going to be a property of the fact that this thing holds. And so you don't need to worry so much about the nature of the decoding. Of course, in the proof, it manifests itself. But there's really all reasonable choices are going to work. Are going to give you the same answer. So I guess this is the very famous, very standard probabilistic method construction all the way back to 1948. I was having a discussion with some people the other day, and we realized we didn't know what the first applications of the probabilistic method were. And there are, of course, Erdős and sort of random graphs and so on. But if people in this audience know something about the history of the probabilistic method, I wouldn't mind if you grab my sleeve and tell me a little bit about it. Okay. So now on the quantum side, a less famous analog. And we're in Canada. Analog. Well, okay. Before we actually do this, we have to make some sense of what does it mean to be on the quantum side? I may have overestimated how long my talk is going to take, but if we're done a little bit early and have time for discussion, that's all okay. So anticipating that it's going to take longer than the 40 minutes allotted to me, I started sketching out my dictionary beforehand. And if you're comfortable, with these ideas of say classical information theory, in this rudimentary way that I've just sketched it out here, then to get comfortable at least with maybe not defining quantum information problems yourself, but with the objects that you're going to encounter, it doesn't take a lot of work. So let's see, what are the bits and pieces that one has when one's talking about computer science or information theory? The basic unit of information, right, is just the bit. you know, we build up things from bits, basically, you know, most of the time, or more generally, sort of finite sense. So on the quantum side, what's going to replace the bit is this qubit. So just a two-dimensional vector space, basically. Really, the unit vectors in some two-dimensional vector space. And that's because the state space in quantum mechanics is linear. And so if you have, you know, if you have two states, then linear combinations of those states are also states. And so this is, you know, instead of working just in some in a finite set that has no structure, you're working in a vector space, and actually in an inner product space. And in quantum mechanics in general, one worries about, you know, infinite dimensional vector spaces for the same reason that when we're talking about computer science and information theory, we typically restrict to finite sets, and it becomes one of combinatorial questions. In quantum information theory, we're usually interested in finite dimensional vector spaces because we're interested in information that we can manipulate and protect. And when you go to the continuous variable setting, that's not really the case, although you may encode finite amounts of quantum information in continuous variables. All right, so if we have this basic building block, the bit, what can we do with it? Well, we'd like to take strings of bits, you know, sequences. And so, well, you just, how do you do that? You just concatenate, right? With qubits, you also, in some sense, just concatenate. And what that means is that a system of n qubits is actually the n-fold tensor product of these two-dimensional vector spaces. So it is itself a vector space now of dimension 2 to the n. And it's, you know, you might ask, well, why the tensor product? And if you think in terms of the original setting, you know, that we were talking about bits, it's really the natural thing. Because you can say, well, let's look at all of the possible bit strings of n bits, right? So that's what I have here. And let's let those be an orthonormal basis for a vector space. That vector space is this tensor product, like so. And that actually, you know, luckily, corresponds reasonably well to what happens if you have a bunch of particles, each of which has two states, and you say, okay, I now have n particles. What is the state space of this n particle system? It's going to be a tensor product. Okay, so to talk about information theory, we have to go a little bit further, right? We have to start talking about, well, uncertainty in some form. And that gives us probability theory when we're talking about, you know, classical objects. You know, in bits, so we might have a probability density over bit strings, for example. Now, on the quantum side, again, in this finite dimensional setting at least, what's going to replace the probability density is something very much analogous to it, called the density operator. And I guess I'm going to introduce a little bit of a notation. So rho is a density operator acting on the vector space A, right? Sorry? Yeah.
I'm just curious a little more about what you mean by uncertainty. Do you mean uncertainty in terms of what your message is, or uncertainty? I'd like a little more.
Okay. Well, yeah, I didn't know. In my notes, actually, I had this spot blank because I didn't know what word to put there. So I'm like, well, we want to talk about probabilities, or we want to... So you want some formalism that allows you to deal with a situation where you might have quantum states, but you don't know, you know, there is some uncertainty about which quantum states are present. So for example, you might have a probability density over quantum states themselves, and you want to be able to make predictions.
Sure, but a probability distribution of states is different from a density operator.
It is, but for...
For the purposes of this conversation. Okay.
Yeah. So it's not, I mean... You won't be able to take. It's not necessarily the case that you can just, you know, if you have some statement that involves these objects, if you just substitute in, you know,
right,
Functorially these objects, then you'll get some other statement that makes sense. But this density operator thing. So what is the set? So rho is a Hermitian matrix acting on A with two properties. Its trace is equal to 1. And I'll write it this way. Rho is greater than or equal to 0, by which I mean rho is positive semi-definite. So there, this is very much just a non-commutative analog of the probability density. Because a Hermitian rho is diagonalizable, right?
And by virtue of the fact that its trace is 1 and it's positive semi-definite, the eigenvalues themselves form a probability density. And so this space of density operators really is, you know, in some very natural way, a set of non-commutative probability densities.
On the left, because they're both densities, right? Just for a commutative and non-commutative measure, or not?
Fair enough. Yeah. So I mostly put the words here because I figure people are going to be using this terminology through the rest of 3 days, and so I wanted to write down the terminology. But it's exactly right: commutative and non-commutative densities. And at least to make sense of this. This problem right here, we also need some notion of noisy evolution, right? And in the case of the classical noisy channels, these were just stochastic maps. Now, in the case of in the quantum mechanical setting,
this is actually, you know, I guess, sort of the key construction. Or what we need is a map. So what we need, I'll write some n, is our noisy map. It's going to map density operators to density operators. And the input spaces and the output spaces might be different, right? So this is going to be a linear map. And it's going to have whatever properties are necessary in order that it actually maps densities to densities, right? And actually, it's going to need a little bit more. So there's a little asterisk there. So what properties does it need to have? Well, if we look at the definition of the set, right, these are operators that have trace 1, right? And so trace 1 operators have to be mapped to trace 1 operators. So these linear maps have to be trace preserving. Yep.
The system is closed.
Yeah, this is true. But that's also true on the left-hand side, right? That if the system's not closed, then I don't necessarily have to have a stochastic map, but
it could be sub-stochastic.
It could be sub-stochastic.
So here could be trace non-increasing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sublinear.
Yeah. Still linear. But it doesn't necessarily need to preserve the trace. It could decrease the trace. So let's say, you know, assuming that it's closed, we're preserving the trace, and we're also we need to preserve this property of being positive semi-definite, right? Now it turns out that's where there's a little subtlety that comes in, that the property of preserving positive semi-definiteness
is not necessarily stable under tensoring with the identity, and so the stable version of this is known as complete positivity. So this map n, when we tensor with an arbitrary identity map, has to preserve positivity. But I'm sure other people are going to talk about it. So morally, you know, or at least intuitively, all you have to think about is these noisy maps are just going to be linear maps that take density operators to density operators. Okay. Well, there's at least one more important point to be made, right? So I said at the beginning that our state space, you know, if you just go, even the smallest non-trivial quantum system has a two-dimensional state space, and the states are all of these different unit vectors. And so there are infinite number of states. And so you might imagine that even the smallest quantum system can contain, in some sense, an infinite amount of information. And that it doesn't really work that way. And that the reason is that these individual quantum states are not necessarily perfectly distinguishable from each other. So when we talk about probability distributions, there are different ways of measuring the distinguishability of two different probability distributions, but the total variation distance is, you know, very well motivated from in an operational sense. And for two probability densities, P and Q, you just add up the sums of the absolute values of the differences of PIs and QIs. So what should you do for two density operators? I guess I should have a little... Well, for two density operators, I'll write it down. Looks exactly the same. You have to look at this quantity. So if rho and sigma are density operators, you have to look at this thing, which is now the nuclear norm, the trace norm. The nuclear norm. So it's the sum of the singular values of the operators, or rather of the operator. And in this case, rho and sigma are Hermitian, so it's the sum of the absolute values of the eigenvalues of the difference. And it turns out that this is well-motivated in exactly the same sense that that the total variation distance is well-motivated. But what does that imply for these qubits, right? So I should actually just introduce a little bit more notation that you're going to see ad nauseum over the next 3 days. So I use this funny notation for a vector. I put a flag on it, right? So that's just called a ket, as in a Bra-ket, Dirac-Bra-ket notation. So if we have some phi that is an A, then an A is some inner product space, then I can define the reversed flag to just be the adjoint. So, like so. And this has the nice prop. I guess I actually, I'm sorry, I even used that notation here. I meant the inner product, the length squared of the vector. So once you have this funny notation, this allows you to, for example, just write down the inner product as the product of a Bra and a ket. And it also has another nice feature. So let's say this is an inner product. Whereas, again, if the phis are normalized, this thing is a rank one projector. And a rank one projector is a special case of a density operator, right? Because it's a positive semi-definite operator whose trace is one. And that's actually how you go from this qubit state space to the density operator space, is that you replace the vector by the associated rank one projector. And so if you have two vectors that are not orthogonal, so the maximum possible value of this difference here is two. And it's only going to be two if you have two operators that are orthogonal, including in the special case where you're talking about qubits. And so qubits are not, even though you have an infinite number of states in the qubit space, those states are not distinguishable in general. You only have two orthogonal distinguishable states. So this is the kind of dictionary that we're going to use. Does that make sense for everyone? Or is everyone comfortable with that? There are lots of things that I've left out here. As people give their talks over the course of the week, they're going to have to fill in bits that I've left out. I've left out some very important bits, but this is going to be enough for my purposes. So I should say that when I say a less famous analog here, I wanted to just do some example that was relatively straightforward. And so I had to wait until the abstracts all came in for the different talks this week, because I didn't want to do something that someone was already doing. And luckily, one of my favorite problems, no one was going to touch on it. So you might, again, some of the people in the audience might be worrying that I'm going to, cover their talk, but I'm not. I'm going to do something else. So the less famous analog. So the less famous analog is quantum error correction. What we have over, in the case of Shannon's noisy coding theorem, is a way of correcting bits, right? If you have some errors on your bits, it tells you a way to construct a code that's going to allow you to encode your bits robustly such that you can actually undo the effects of noise. And so what I want to talk about here is how to actually construct quantum error correcting codes. And those quantum error correcting codes are naturally going to be associated with some random matrices. So what do we need to do? Well, we need to first define a noise model, right? We had our binary symmetric channel up there. So I'm going to talk about something called a Pauli channel down here. So what is the Pauli channel? N of rho. So rho is a density operator. N is now my noisy channel. It's supposed to be a linear map. It's supposed to be trace-preserving. It's supposed to send positive semi-definite to positive semi-definite. So here's how I'm going to define it. Sum from I equals 0 to 3 of pi sigma I, rho, sigma I. I'll put a dagger on for good measure, just so it's manifestly Hermitian. So what are these things? Well, the PIs are supposed to form probability density. But you can choose them however you want, subject to that constraint. And then these sigma I's are supposed to be Pauli operators, which you've probably seen before. So sigma 0 will be the identity. Sigma 1 will be the bit flip. So if we only had these two operators, we'd have some very general quantum mechanical generalized version of the binary symmetric channel, right? Because with some probability, we'd do nothing. And with some probability, we'd flip our bit. But we're talking about qubits now, so there are many more possibilities. There are many more invertible functions from a qubit than from a bit to a bit, right? From this actually defines the only invertible functions from a bit to a bit, right? Do nothing or flip the bit. But with qubits, you can apply arbitrary unitary transformations. So sigma 2, 0 minus I, 0, and sigma 3, 1 minus 1, 0, 0. This may seem a little bit arbitrary, but actually, in some sense, it's the most general channel that has the property that it acts on a qubit and it preserves the identity operator. So this is a pretty general noise model, certainly one that seems to be analogous and generalizes this binary symmetric channel. And we'd like to use it in a communication system. So how do we use it in a communication system? Well, as before, we're not going to get very far if we're only allowed a single use, right? If we want to be able to send longer messages and have some hope of correcting the noise, we maybe have to use this channel many times. And because it's going to have to act on then many inputs, many input qubits, it's going to act as the tensor product. So we'll have an in part and an out part, just like our communication system up there. And there's going to have to be, then, some kind of encoding, some kind of decoding. And what are those encodings and decodings? Well, they are themselves, they've got to be channels of some type, right? So they have to have the same property, that these linear maps that take density operators to density operators in a strong sense. So that's what the communication system looks like. But what's it supposed to do, right? And this is where what I'm going to tell you now diverges. A significant fraction of Wednesday is going to be about this type, you know, problems of this spirit. But they're going to be the goal, you know, what it is you're trying to accomplish with your communication system is different. So I want to really have, you know, a version of this problem that involves mindlessly going from the left-hand column to the right-hand column without worrying so much if it makes sense. And it does, but it actually does make sense. So my inputs now, instead of being bits, right, my messages are not going to be bits. My messages are going to be qubits. Okay, and it's going to be qubits that are corrupted by the noise. So my inputs are going to be phi in some space of m qubits. And so my input channel is going to act on the corresponding density operator. And then what comes out of this thing is going to be a density operator, which I'll call phi tilde. And what I want is for this phi tilde to look, you know, to be very, very similar to the input phi. And how do we determine that it's very similar? Well, I've given you some definition and try to assure you that it actually is a well-motivated definition operationally. So what we want is that the input phi should be close to the output phi. Let's say it's smaller than epsilon, for all input normalized states. Right? That's the kind of condition that we're going to aim for. And we want this epsilon to go to zero as the number of channel uses goes to infinity.
It's not a
rank one.
Oh, yeah. In general, it's not rank one, definitely.
It's rho t.
Not five.
I could call it rho. I use the same name just to indicate that it's supposed to be the same thing, but the tilde is supposed to indicate that it's no longer.
So why don't you restrict that the output should be qubits also?
As in restricted to be a pure state? Or rather to be a rank one density operator?
Yes.
Well, the difficulty is that it's just...
Then you can interpret it as qubits.
It's actually... The problem is that you can't actually find appropriate E's and D's to make that happen.
Okay.
No,
what do you mean? To make it happen is no problem. The problem is small error.
The problem is small L?
Small error.
Oh,
make it happen. I'm easily
well,
making
but
it happen.
The errors are actually.
But D
really
doesn't look at what comes in.
Yeah. depending on what N does, there's a range of different possible values, right? You should think of N as being stochastic.
Right.
And so if there's any probability of error in this formalism, then this is going to be some mixed state, most likely, some density operator. I mean, it could be a rank one density operator that is close in this sense to the one that you're aiming for, but it just turns out that it's more than you can hope to achieve. That what ends up happening is you generally have you can't get away from acquiring higher rank, even though you can concentrate most of the weight of that operator very close to the projector that you're looking for. So you need the flexibility both sort of in the inner product space to get some vector that's close to the one you're aiming for, and you need the flexibility to have more than one mixtures of operators that give you higher rank.
Maybe just trying to offer some tea.
Yeah.
If you think about the simplest possible kind of evolution that can take place, where you have just a single value or a single unitary operator instead of a full channel,
yeah,
that is keeping the purity, is keeping the qubit to be a pure state to a pure state. But as soon as you have a mixture of operators acting in the channel, this cannot happen.
Yeah.
But in general, if
your goal was to make this a pure state here, right, so one that had rank one, then your options are pretty limited. This thing here would effectively have to perform some kind of, well, we haven't talked about what measurements are, and then perform some preparation, but it's actually going to be limited. It's not going to have enough resolution in some sense.
I guess what the author probably says is that if all operations here are linear and you start with just a single vector, it is mapped to a single vector.
Well, but you start out with you don't start out with a vector. You start out with a density operator. Right, so it's a linear map on density operators, but not a linear map on the vectors. So it takes this thing, which is a matrix, and produces a matrix at the output, in general, higher rank. So I agree. I don't think my answer is entirely satisfactory, but I can sort of work through an example with you, I'll try to think of a very clear answer because they're very good reasoning that won't work. So this is what we're aiming for, and the question that we need to ask is the same question that we had over here, which is how to find it. Well, actually, that might even be more than we can hope for. How to find a good E. Now, there was one line on the dictionary that I left out here, right? So, in the case of bits, we had some notion of a deterministic evolution, right? Which is actually what our function made use of. Right? That if we have two spaces, you know, classical state spaces, we can just have a function from one to the other, and that's a deterministic evolution. And the analog on the quantum side, so distinguishability in this inner product space is measured by the inner product, right, as you might expect. And so something that preserves the distinguishability is a unitary transformation, or if you're increasing the dimension, a map which is an isometry onto its range. So a linear map on the vectors, right, so this U. But when we think of that map acting on density operators, it has to act by conjugation, right, which is natural because, remember, the density operator associated to a vector is this projector. So we act from the left by U and from the right by its adjoint.
Okay, so anyone want to hazard a guess? Our starting point here is that we know nothing. We just have some noisy channel that's supposed to be our encoding. So does it give us any does it help at all to make that channel noisy? No, right? And so what we should actually use as our encoding is some kind of an isometry. So our E acting on something will have the form of conjugation by a matrix, which is an isometry. Okay. But how do we go about finding an isometry that's going to do a good job? Again, I'm not going to insult your intelligence by requiring you to put up your hand. We just do exactly the analogous thing that we did right here. We want to choose our isometry randomly somehow. And in the absence of having any better ideas, we sort of take the most ignorance approach. What about just choosing the isometry according to the unitarily invariant measure? Right. So.
Yeah, so what you can do, for example, using the isometry, you can identify the code with a subspace of the qubits right here, and then use the unitarily invariant measure there. So that's what this code is going to be. It's going to be effectively a subspace of the input space. And because we don't really know how to make these codes, or at least I haven't told you how to make such codes, we just say, well, let's just do the stupidest possible thing, which is to choose using the unitarily invariant measure. Now, if you sort of formally at this point, we actually have a random matrix problem, right? We have what looks like it might be a random matrix problem, because the isometry E defines an encoding E, and the composition of E in the noisy channel is itself a matrix acting on the linear space of input density operators, right? We can make it a little bit more explicit and see where the random matrix problem comes out of this. I should point out one thing. Okay, so I tell you that this is actually a fairly reasonable thing to do. And in what sense is it a reasonable thing to do? Well, we should get some reasonable rate if we choose our encodings this way. And what is the rate? Well, the rate is the number of the number of qubits we manage to encode over the total number of qubits that we have to send. We want to make a guess of what the function is going to be. Again, this is supposed to be direct translation from left to right. We get that rate. Where now this entropy function is a little bit more general. Like so. So this is known as the hashing bound, and it actually goes back all the way to 1996. Bennett, DiVincenzo, Smolin, and Wooders. They didn't prove it the same way, right? The way that they came up with these codes doesn't look. They didn't use this unitarily invariant measure. They didn't talk about random matrices, but they figured out how to achieve this rate. And where does the random matrix come from? And I think there's actually an open question here, even. But I'll ask the audience if it really makes any sense.
The lower bound, right?
Only
in the achievability, not in the best.
Yes.
What is the analog of Fano?
So we have some analog of Fano. Like I have to introduce the information quantities, And actually, on the last day, like on the third day of the workshop, people are going to talk about an analogous or a similar problem where the goal is not to send quantum states, but to send classical information through quantum channels. And there, random matrices are going to be used to sort of study the optimality. So they're useful on both sides of the game.
But are you saying that the achievability with quantum capacity can be all done by those operations? You don't need anything else?
So what we get, the best known general achievable rates, you can get them with the random with essentially this construction. But we also know that it's not optimal. So it's optimal for some types of channels, but in particular for the type of channels that I've written down there, we know it's optimal, that we have codes that are better than this. But we don't have any sort of general structure to those codes that allow us to translate them for arbitrary channels, or to prove that they're optimal. So this is the best general purpose thing we have. Okay, so
let's let L and M be the inputs.
Get copies of the input space, right? So we had n qubits on the input space. And you're going to see this type of state many times, I'm pretty sure. This is going to be a maximally entangled state, so I'll use the capital phi. So some sum over n-bit strings of EM. These guys are supposed to be orthonormal. EM. So it looks like a perfectly correlated distribution of M bits, but it's actually the analogous quantum state. It's perfectly correlated. Now, on the left-hand side, it was more or less sufficient to think about the encoding, and because the decoding came along for free. And the same is actually true over here. That if we now draw, this is kind of a tensor network, so the input is going to be phi that has a message part, say an L part. So this is what this notation means, right? Each of these lines corresponds to some quantum system, and I'm labeling it by the subscript. Let's say L and M. So we act by E on the M system, and then we act by N copies of the noise. And let's call the output here B N copies. We'll call that A N copies. So this is some quantum state that's associated to the encoding and the channel. And now we can play a little game, which is to notice, and I'm almost done, that N of rho, right, our polychannel, it can be written, I'll say a trace over C of a U N rho U N dagger, or adjoint. So what is this notation? This is going to be some matrix that I define. And then I'm going to take, and U is going to map A to B tensor C.
Oh,
sorry, thanks. Yeah.
So you mean M? I think you're using M for A
here. No, because I'm interested in the N map. So it has an A input and a B input. So what I mean by trace over C, trace is a linear map, so I'm going to have the trace acting on the C system, but I'm not going to have, I'm going to have the identity acting on the B system, okay? And the way that I define the U is just as follows. So U sub N acting on some state phi is going to be the sum from I equals 0 to 3 of the square root of pi, sigma I, phi, and then I. where again these guys are supposed to be orthonormal. So now this is a little linear algebra exercise for you. So I should put a tensor product here. Good measure. For you to check. So the assertion that I've made is that if we define these U's this way, then this formula, where I trace over the C system of conjugating by U, gives me exactly the same transformation as that polychannel up there. But the nice thing about this version of the transformation is that the U acts sort of in the qubit space, right? It acts in the vector space, not in the density operator space. And so I could think of the associated isometry here, U sub n, that has two outputs. And this now allows us to talk about our random matrix. Let's call this sigma of L Bn Cn. So I'm using the subscripts to label the systems that are present. Okay. And I need a little bit more space. I'll just go here. So sigma of L, Bn, Cn, this is a density operator, right? And it's a density operator that is a function of the encoding, right? And so it's a random density operator if we allow the encoding to be selected, the E of the encoding, the isometry of the encoding, to be selected according to the unitarily invariant measure. And the existence of a D of that decoding, which is what we're looking for, right? That's what we need in order to be able to perform quantum error correction. It only depends on, I'll write sigma L Cn So if I take the original, the density operator for the whole thing, and then I want to get rid of the B degrees of freedom, right? So I can take the trace, apply the trace to the B degrees of freedom, right? So that's like taking the marginal of the probability distribution. Then I get a density operator on the L and C systems alone. And the existence of a decoding only depends on this density operator, which is a random density operator. And I could even say a little bit more. Now, so there are random matrix theorists in the audience. What do we need to know about this density operator in order to be able to claim that an encoding exists? So what we need, so for rough estimates, we need to do something that isn't going to challenge your average random matrix theorist. We need to study the trace of sigma L Cn squared. So that is the sum of the squares of the eigenvalues of this operator. And that allows us to get some rough estimates on whether or not, basically, the smaller this is, the better. And if it's small enough, then we get good error correcting codes. And in particular, we get the rates that I told you we achieve here. And so that's all, you know, if you actually want to be able to determine that you can achieve these rates, you really just have to study this function. But those are only rough estimates. And these are rough estimates, and they're the ones that we know how to do. What you're really interested in, so to be precise, you're interested in how close the sigma LCN is. So we're using that norm now. So sigma sub L is just going to be sigma of LCN, and then I trace over the C degrees of freedom. Sigma sub CN is going to be the same thing I trace over the L degrees of freedom. I want to know how close it is to being product in this trace norm. And I have to tell you, I don't know how to calculate this, right? So if I choose the unitarily invariant measure over the isometric encodings, if someone can tell me how to evaluate the sum of the singular values of these difference of non-commuting matrices, I would be very happy. Maybe Andreas or Aram or someone in the audience can correct me. Do we actually know that? So we know that we can achieve, say, this rate
using the random unitary encodings, the random isometric encodings. Do we know that we don't achieve a better rate?
Do we actually know that we don't achieve a better rate?
I think so.
Yeah.
Because Eve's entropy is going to be as high as it can be.
Okay, so yeah.
But we've probably only thought about it for a total of 22 seconds.
Yeah. Okay. So, I didn't think that we could, but we probably can't achieve rates better than this using this technique. But all we know is the first order
behavior. So if you really want to actually know what's happening more precisely, what you'd like to be able to estimate is this type of quantity. And so I have some faith that there are probably some people in the audience who could tell me how to evaluate that quantity if they think about it for long enough. So I should let you go to the coffee break now. This was supposed to be a bit of an introduction to how random matrices appear in quantum information. And at least I hope that I've given you, a little bit of what you need to be able to translate between the two, and also indicated that you don't have to try very hard, right? That if you just take the most direct possible quantum mechanical translation of a natural problem, in this case, you want to relate classical error correction to quantum error correction, the success criterion for your quantum error correction really is a kind of random matrix problem. And you're going to see stuff like this over and over again during the course of the next 2 days. And there are many different ways that random matrices appear in quantum information. Like here we have random density operators. Other people are going to talk about random quantum mechanical channels. I guess we have both a random channel and a random density operator associated to the channel. And that kind of thing is going to happen a lot. People are going to talk about random Hamiltonians. There's, of course, a whole community of people who look at random Hamiltonians. And there's some connections there to quantum computation, which I haven't discussed at all. One thing I'll add just before we leave. This is completely existential, this type of argument, right? So I can tell you a U exists, right? If I do my averaging and the average value looks good, then I can say there's some U that's going to do the job for you. That U is, in general, completely impractical. That if you were going to try to implement it on a quantum computer, the quantum computer would have to run for an amount of time exponential in the number of input qubits, right? So it's totally, totally impractical. And so there's a whole question about how you can actually replace, for example, or can you replace the unitarily invariant measure with something simpler that you might be able to implement efficiently? And so there's at least one talk on random quantum circuits of smaller size that will converge in a sense strong enough to allow you to recover these results without having to use the fully unitarily invariant measure, which is impractical. That's it. You can have your first coffee of the day, and thanks for listening.